Today is Tuesday, January 30th. We're going to wrap up blood and blood disorder information today. Okay, so page 23 was where we left off on Thursday of last week. I'd like to start by going over a view of hemoglobin with you. Hemoglobin is a protein found inside our red blood cells, and it's important for transporting both oxygen and carbon dioxide. You know, I might have mentioned to you that the magic number here for hemoglobin was 4. Good. There are 4 polypeptide chains. They are globin chains. Of course, that's part of the word hemoglobin. There are 4 heme groups. They are sitting inside each of those globin chains. And what special metal is found with the heme group?
Iron.
Iron, good. Why is iron important to a hemoglobin molecule?
Binds the
O2, good. And when oxygen binds that iron molecule, what color does your red blood cell become?
Red.
Good, very bright red. And when oxygen unbinds from hemoglobin, the red blood cell becomes?
Darker red,
right. And in fact, the coloration there indicates whether we have oxyhemoglobin in the bright red state or deoxy, exactly. So deoxyhemoglobin simply means that we have lost some oxygens. They have diffused away from your red blood cells into your cells and tissues, and that allows for your cells and tissues to make ATP. I did want to mention this as well, that carbon dioxide can bind to a hemoglobin molecule. It does not bind to the iron on the heme group. Instead, it binds to the hemoglobin globin chains, and that way there's not really a competition for transport. So we're not looking at those two molecules, oxygen and CO2, trying to fight it out for a ride on the best seat, which is the iron molecule. So we'll talk a little more about the transport of CO2 when we get into the respiratory system. I also wanted to show you this. The oxygen and the hemoglobin actually have a relationship with each other. It's called affinity. What do you think that means between oxygen and hemoglobin? If I have an affinity for chocolate, then
I love
it, yeah. So if oxygen and hemoglobin have an affinity, they love each other, right? Okay, so you'll notice that this hemoglobin is actually changing shape when oxygen binds and unbinds, and that's due to the affinity of hemoglobin and oxygen for one another. In other words, what this means is if you have seats available, going back here, if you have seats available on your iron molecules, then hemoglobin says, it's kind of like a taxi cab. They open the door and they say, come for a ride, got a seat for you. And so they open their doors and they say, hey, oxygen molecules, I have seats, won't you come for a ride with me? And so when you see it shifting shape in this picture, it's actually saying, I got a ride, come with me. Okay, so it maximizes the number of oxygen molecules that you can bind and take for a ride. So we'll come back to this conversation in respiratory and talk about why it's important to transport a total of 4 oxygens per hemoglobin molecule. That's the max number you can transport. Okay, so that should do it for page 23. How about questions there? Okay.
This is going to be a silly question, but for the oxyhemoglobin, you know, it's like ruby red. Is that only whenever it's inside? Because, you know, when you get a cut, it's like it's darker. Is that whenever the oxygen kind of leaves it or something?
Yeah, because you're right. If you get a cut and it's a very dark red color, those blood cells have probably died that are stuck in your cut. And when they die, they're going to lose oxygen. And then you're exactly right. They're going to be a dark red color.
Okay.
Yeah. And the reason a bruise is blue, goodness, everything from yellow, green, blue to black is due to the death of those red blood cells. Yeah, so we'll talk a little bit about that too. Let me flip you on over to page 24. Near the top of page 24, you'll want to highlight or know the normal blood cell count, which is 4 to 6 million red blood cells in a cubic millimeter of blood. Let me put this in perspective. A cubic millimeter is a very small drop of blood. very small drop of blood, and you're transporting about 5 total liters of blood. So when we're talking about 4 to 6 million red blood cells in a cubic millimeter, I'm not implying that you have only 4 to 6 million in your entire body. I just mean in something that's an incredibly small drop of blood, you have 4 to 6 million red blood cells. Multiply that out by the 5 liters that you're circulating, and that's a lot of cells, right? You're talking trillions of red blood cells in circulation. Okay, the next thing that I would highlight there is the lifespan, which is about 120 days. Okay, so the lifespan, about 120 days. Why don't red blood cells live much longer? They get used up, and what do they not have to repair themselves? Nucleus, yeah. They don't have a nucleus. They don't have many organelles. So once they're worn out, your body just says, all right, take them out, replace them with new ones. Okay? So it's kind of like having disposable cells. Use them, burn through them. When they're worn out, replace them. So let's talk about replacing worn out red blood cells. If you have a spleen, then your spleen is the primary location for removing worn out blood cells. I want you to think about a sponge for just a moment. You know, sponges have holes in them, big holes and small holes. Imagine if you were to pour blood through a sponge. Some of those blood cells would get trapped by the smaller holes on the sponge. Those are the ones that are trapped in the spleen and removed from circulation. So we take those that get kind of trapped in the spongy-like texture of the spleen from circulation, and then we say, okay, we've removed these, we're going to put some more back in from the red bone marrow. Okay, if you happen to have no spleen, your liver becomes the place where we remove those red blood cells from circulation. So you can live without a spleen. Your liver just picks up this, the job of this red blood cell recycling. Okay, so there's 3 big components of a red blood cell, and those components really come from the hemoglobin molecule. So when we look at a hemoglobin molecule, we have iron, we have a heme group, and we have those globin chains. So the iron molecules are actually kept. They are retained by your body. Your liver is going to play a role here in making new red blood cells using iron from old red blood cells. If you have iron deficiency anemia, which is a more common thing for females than it is for males, then we have to look at your liver because it's involved in making sure that there's enough iron present for you to make new red blood cells. Interesting how nothing here is wasted. We take the heme groups from your hemoglobin molecules and we break it down to become bile. So we don't actually get rid of that heme group. We're going to turn it into something, you know, useful for the digestive system. Your digestive system will then use bile to break down fatty molecules. Here's an interesting thought. What color is bile? Kind of a green yellow, yeah. And what color are some bruises? Green and yellow, yep. So when you break down the heme group from a hemoglobin molecule, you know, part of it can go and make bile from the heme group, use it in the digestive system. And likewise, if you bruise yourself and you've got damaged blood cells there, the breakdown of the heme group also becomes a greenish-yellow color. Blue if it's cyanotic, okay, and then green to yellow once you start seeing the breakdown of the bruise. It's interesting, if you get bruised, nobody wants a bruise though, but if you get bruised and it starts out kind of a blackish blue color, that's due to cyanosis, meaning what? Lack of oxygen, good. As the bruise begins to heal, you'll notice it changes color into what colors?
Yellow
and green, yeah. And so that's the further breakdown of those heme groups that were in the hemoglobin molecules. So you can kind of watch the progression of the bruise heal as it goes from bluish black to a greenish yellow color. And then, of course, that's pretty much the last stage, and then we've healed that bruise. So interesting to understand that that comes from those heme groups in the hemoglobin molecules. Those globin chains actually are going to be reused to make new proteins, maybe for red blood cells, maybe for other proteins in your body. But we do reuse those amino acids for other purposes. Okay. Any questions so far about the lifespan or the recycling process? So since we're constantly replacing worn-out blood cells, we have to have a new supply coming in all the time. And the process of making new blood cells in general is called hematopoiesis. Okay, and this is just all blood cell types. This is red blood cells, white blood cells, and platelets. This process occurs in red bone marrow. What's the difference between red marrow and yellow marrow? That's right. Yellow marrow stores fat. It's an energy storage site. Red marrow is more, you know, really for the production of new red blood cells. White blood cells, platelets too. Can you think of some bones that are great sources of red bone marrow?
Femur.
Femur, good. How about the location in a lot of our bones? Yeah, medulla, that medullary cavity, the hollow part. Good.
Yes.
And where else? How about the spongy bone marrow? So that spongy bone has a bunch of open hollow spaces. That is a great place for us to also store red bone marrow and make new blood cells. So as we get older, we do notice that the location of red bone marrow shifts from the diaphysis, which is the, you know, shaft of the bone where there's a hollow portion inside, to some more of that spongy bone in other bones like, say, ribs, sternum, hip bones even. You can even make it in your vertebrae, and you're right, even in the femur, but it does shift toward those spongy bone cavities. The cell that gives rise to all blood cells is called a hemocytoblast. Breaking down that word, what is hemo as a prefix? Blood, good. And cyto? Good. And blast? Formation, yeah, good. So it's a forming cell, so a blood-forming cell, good. This is a family tree for the blood cells in our bodies. You'll notice that the stem cell, the one that gives rise to all other cell types, is the one at the very top. That is our hemocytoblast. You know, if you have problems in bone marrow with the hemocytoblast, what kinds of cells are now affected?
All of them.
So that's why, you know, bone marrow cancers that may affect this lineage up here near the top can have devastating effects on all the cells that come from those precursor stem cells. We're going to focus only on the red blood cell lineage. We're going to leave the white blood cells and the platelets alone, but those red blood cells are going to be made in the bone marrow, just like other kinds of blood cells. But there's another hormone here that helps to induce red blood cell formation. So let me take you there next. This process of making red blood cells specifically is called erythropoiesis. And guess what? The hormone's name is erythropoietin, and we can call it EPO for short. Okay, so the red blood cells are made by way of erythropoiesis. And the name of the hormone that induces erythropoietin or poiesis is called erythropoietin. Let's call it EPO for short. So this hormone is made by your kidneys when your kidneys filter blood. Your kidneys are going to filter blood all day, every day. And it's a great location for our bodies to detect if there's a low oxygen level. The low oxygen level could indicate that we don't have enough red blood cells, and if that's the case, then our kidneys say we're going to help this by releasing EPO into the bloodstream. We know that all hormones travel via the bloodstream to their target organs. So what is the target organ of EPO? Red bone marrow. Good. So kidneys make EPO. EPO, in turn, targets your bone marrow, okay? And then the bone marrow receives the message, EPO tells your bone marrow to make more red blood cells. Okay, so the feedback loop here is a negative feedback loop. So let me give an example of how this might work. If you go to the mountains where there's less oxygen in the air, your body may pick up on the fact that there is less oxygen in transport. If there's less oxygen in transport in your bloodstream, which organs now release EPO?
Kidneys.
Kidneys, good. In about 3 to 7 days, your red bone marrow will have now picked up production and made more what?
Red blood cells,
right. So EPO is going to have about a 3 to 7 day lag time in terms of getting more red blood cells in circulation. So let's imagine this. If you go to some really high altitude mountains for the weekend, okay, and you're only there 2 or 3 days, are you going to be assisted by EPO while you're there?
No.
You go home and you may feel better. But while you're in those high altitude mountains, you're probably not going to feel the effects of getting more EPO. All right, so this process is going to occur over about 3 to 7 days. I know you can't read the fine print over there on the far right, but I would like you to look at the pictures. Notice that some of those pictures have a purplish-blue nucleus, right? And then down here near the bottom, they don't look purplish-blue anymore. They look clear. So over the course of those 3 to 7 days of making those new red blood cells, we go through an evolution. Those cells are changing. They're undergoing mitosis. But down here near the bottom, this cell is called a reticulocyte, and you'll notice it has lost its nucleus. That is what is sent from your bone marrow into your bloodstream. We say that it's been ejected from your marrow into your bloodstream for circulation. Now, the catch is a reticulocyte is not a mature red blood cell. It cannot transport oxygen. It does not have matured hemoglobin quite yet. Give it a couple of days, and those reticulocytes mature their hemoglobin, and then what do we call them?
Red blood cells.
Red blood cells, yeah. So I just want to mention that if you want to see what your up-and-coming population of red blood cells is going to be, measure your reticulocyte population. So if you want to know 2 days from now how many red blood cells you're going to have, measure your reticulocytes. Why do you not get a true read on your red blood cell population if you only measure them? Yeah, what's happening to red blood cells all day, every day?
They're dying.
They're dying, yeah. So you may have a mass die-off one day, and that can impact your ability to transport oxygen. So if you want to know what's coming up in terms of new cells, that's why they say measure those reticulocytes. So if you get a blood report, like if you've had a complete blood count done, they may in fact post on there your reticulocyte population, and you'll know that, well, 2 to 3 days after that blood test was done, this is what I was going to be circulating. Okay, any questions about EPO? So where's EPO made? And what is the stimulus?
Oxygen,
good. And we target the bone marrow, and about how long does it take to make new red blood cells?
3 to 7 days.
Good. Okay, so kind of just take a detour here for a side topic for just a moment. Have you heard of blood doping? Okay, in what frame of reference?
Athletes,
good. And what do you think they're taking injections of? Could be that, yeah. Or less invasive than getting blood cells injected, what else could you take?
Reticulocytes.
Could take reticulocytes, or if you just want...
EPO.
If you want, yeah. EPO is a hormone, yes. Yeah. So if you just want a shot, a one-shot deal, basically, take an EPO injection. Yeah, so that's what blood doping is. They take EPO injections. It is hard to detect in the bloodstream. And then about 3 to 7 days later, voila, you've got more red blood cells. So you are overriding the kidneys and what they're supposed to be doing in regulating that EPO concentration in the bloodstream. Why does this give you an athletic advantage?
Getting more oxygen.
more oxygen. And what is the link between oxygen and energy? More ATP, right? Okay, so we know that glucose and oxygen make ATP in cells. And so, yeah, the more oxygen you are transporting, the more ATP you can make, right? So, of course, this gives you an athletic advantage because now you have more oxygen and more ATP.
Now, could there be like a side effect for taking too many like EPO shots?
There could be, definitely.
Something with the kidneys?
You could have problems with the kidneys. You could have a condition called polycythemia. You could have high blood pressure, and you could have a stroke. Yeah. Winning the race. Stroke. Yeah. But that's, yeah, which one, right? So that's what they have to look at. You may have heard of Lance Armstrong, a cyclist. For years, he denied doing blood doping and then finally came out and said, all right, yep, I did it. He had done it for years. They took away his 7 Tour de France wins because of his blood doping. So, you know, they consider it to be serious business for, you know, for some sports. Of course, the side effect is health-wise what it can do to you. There's another thing that people do to blood dope that doesn't involve EPO injections. Where might you move to induce more EPO production?
Higher
altitudes, right. So, you know, if you want to really ramp up your red blood cell production, go live in the mountains. Or they may live in a chamber, or they may sleep in a chamber that induces more red blood cell production. So if you were sleeping in a specialized chamber, would you sleep in a high oxygen chamber or a low oxygen chamber?
Low
oxygen, right. What does that make your kidneys do? Yeah, produce more EPO, get more red blood cells in circulation. Exactly. So interesting stuff about EPO and the need to win and be first and get that athletic advantage. So interesting stuff there. Okay, a little bit further down in your worksheet, this is still page 24. Let's talk about the bullet point that says we need these dietary requirements to make a red blood cell. All right, so we need iron. That's our first blank. We need vitamin B12. That's our next blank. And we need folic acid. Where does B12 come from? Meats, right. Animal products and meat. B12 does not come in any plant matter. So those who are vegetarians or vegans are not going to get B12 from a strict vegetarian diet. You can only get it from supplements. Supplements of B12 are not well absorbed through the digestive tract, so B12 supplements are best taken as an injection. So that's the way that we get enough B12 into our bodies to make red blood cells. That's why people who take B12 injections are looking for an energy boost because it helps to make those new red blood cells. The other thing here, folic acid is found in cereals and grains. Go to the grocery store and check out the crackers and cookie aisle and the whole grain cereal aisle. A lot of them will say on their product, you know, we have your daily requirement for folic acid. So folic acid, we know, is not only important for making red blood cells, it's also important for moms. Because it helps you prevent what? Spina bifida. Yeah, helps prevent spina bifida in babies, which is a spinal cord closure issue. Basically, the spinal cord tube does not seal up properly, and the baby may have motor disabilities below that point of the spinal cord. Yep. All right. So just to repeat one more time, what is the stimulus for EPO production?
Low
blood oxygen, right. Not to be confused with blood pressure issues. That's an aldosterone issue. Low blood oxygen stimulates EPO. All right. I think that takes you to the bottom of the page. How about questions on page 24? This stuff clicking okay today? Okay. Let's talk white blood cells. They're over on page 25. It's a real general thing to say that white blood cells fight infection. You know, you probably have realized that they do very, very specific jobs, and some of them fight infection. Others are more involved in a more specific type of immunity, things that we're going to get into a little bit here in just a moment. We know that in terms of the anatomy, they are well equipped with a nucleus for repairs. They have most of the organelles. So right there, that makes them quite different from our red blood cells. They also travel in and out of our bloodstream by diapedesis. Diapedesis means to walk across. Literally, they can walk across the walls of your blood vessels. So I kind of have this mental image of these clones of red blood cells just going around and around in your vessels. They never leave your vessels unless the vessel breaks. And then you've got these really sophisticated white blood cells that are coming and going through your vessels. They hop in of your vessel, they hop out. And so you've kind of got this low-tech red blood cell, and then you've got this high-tech white blood cell. And so why do we want those white blood cells to be able to leave your vessel? To fight infection, right. If you've got, say, a bacterial infection on your hand, maybe in the skin there, get those white blood cells to migrate to that area. So that's why it's important for them to move by diapedesis. Red blood cells don't do this. They're just la-la-la floating through your bloodstream. White blood cells are very high-tech. They're going to go where that infection is. And because those white blood cells are very specialized, we can get away with having a much smaller population. This is a number you'll want to highlight. We have around 6,000 to 9,000 per drop of blood, per cubic millimeter. Okay, so 6,000 to 9,000. So compare that to, goodness gracious, 4 to 6 million. The red blood cells outnumber your white blood cells 10 to 1. So that tells you what a very specialized army they are. The lifespan for a white blood cell may be from a few hours to a few days to even years. There's some cells called memory cells. And because they are memory cells, they remember what you've been exposed to. And they may last 20, 40 years. Okay? So we're looking at, depending on what they do, them lasting from hours to days to years. Let's talk about the different types of white blood cells. What's the difference between a granulocyte and the agranulocytes? Good. One has granules, one does not. Which group contains the fills? Granulocytes. Good. And which group contains the sites? Agranulocytes. Good. Which group has big, round nuclei? Agranulocytes, good. And which group contains lobed or sausage-shaped nuclei? Granulocytes, good. All right, so the groups here, we're going to break down first granulocytes, then we'll come back and do those agranulocytes. Those granules in the granulocytes contain stuff that's important. So we're going to talk about what these granules contain. The naming scheme for the granulocytes comes from the stain color that those cells prefer. And so, you know, if you keep in mind the prefix, like eosin, that's actually a stain color. And so that's how we name these white blood cells, is by the stain that they prefer and the color that those granules light up. Let's take the neutrophils first. The neutrophils tend to have a multi-lobe, typically three lobes to a nucleus. Okay, and the granules here are going to stain anywhere from a light pink to a light blue to a neutral color. And the granules are so lightly colored that you're going to be able to see those three lobes of the nucleus very easily without having them be clouded out by those granules. So I know that half of you have had your lab test. What was the telltale sign that you looked for a neutrophil?
Three lobes.
Three lobes. Yeah. Anything else? The nucleus size. Okay. So those are some good things to look for. The nucleus didn't fill up the whole cell, right? Okay, and you're right, the nucleus tends to be sausage or kidney bean shaped, and there's usually around 3 lobes in that nucleus of a neutrophil. Good. Here's a neutrophil on the right side here. It's compared to a lymphocyte. Nice round nucleus in that lymphocyte. And just again for comparison's sake, we have many more red blood cells outnumbering those white blood cells. Okay, so neutrophils are our number one most common white blood cell. And what is their job?
Right.
Good, they kill bacteria, they eat dead cells, they are phagocytes, meaning what? They're eating, good. So they're like hungry, hungry hippos, they're out there eating. So they're gonna be the ones that accumulate if you have a bacterial infection. So if you've got, say, pus that accumulates in a cut, it may in fact be those neutrophils because they are the most common of our white blood cells. All right. Our eosinophils are next. Eosin is a somewhat red, orange, or pink colored stain, and the granules of an eosinophil pick up that stain color. In fact, the granules of an eosinophil are so brightly colored that they will probably cloud out the nucleus in the background. If you can make out the nucleus of an eosinophil, what is the shape?
Two lobes.
Two lobes, good. Now, if you've got an eosinophil and a neutrophil side by side like we do here, what do you do to tell them apart?
Look at the stain.
Look at the stain of the granules, right? And then look at the lobes. And I'm hit the light for just a moment so you can see the difference there. Yeah, so there is your tri-lobe nucleus of a neutrophil. And that looks like 2 kidney beans for the nucleus of the eosinophil. So yeah, nucleus is good. And then these are somewhat pinkish in color for the granules of the eosinophil. And I can't even hardly see granules in the neutrophil. Okay. All right, so what kinds of jobs do eosinophils do?
Fight allergies and parasitic worms.
Good. Fight allergies, fight parasitic worms. Good. I'll tell you an interesting side story. There is research going on right now about, you know, why do people have so many allergies? They don't think that 100, 200, 500 years ago that people had allergies like they do nowadays. You know, if I say who's got allergies, I bet a lot of you would raise your hands, right? Whether it's mosquito bite allergies to mold, hay fever in the spring, peanuts, you know, eggs, we can keep on listing, right? What they think is that we live in an environment with a lot of chemicals that we didn't used to live in. And we think that our body's confused sometimes with those chemicals, and we may, in fact, fight things that are not necessarily harmful. So, you know, mold, not harmful. But if you have a mold allergy, your immune system and these eosinophils go nuts over attacking mold. Okay? So it's like, you know, every time you breathe in mold, they go berserk, and then you have allergies, right? Okay? Same thing with people that eat shrimp and have a shrimp allergy, or eggs with an egg allergy. So what they think is maybe we've got a lot of chemicals in the environment that we didn't used to have, and perhaps we live in an environment that's more clean. You know, we don't live with the windows open like we used to and get all the dust in the house like we used to. So they'd say that maybe our lifestyle changes nowadays have kind of invited our bodies to want to have something to do, and eosinophils may in fact be bored or confused with what they're supposed to attack. So there's a movement in immunology to give people small amounts of parasitic worm infections up under their skin. And what do you think the eosinophils do to that?
They go crazy over it.
They start fighting those parasitic worms. What do they do about your allergies?
Let them be.
Yep. So that's kind of an experiment that they're doing in science right now is, hey, can we get rid of these really severe allergies by entertaining your eosinophils with something else to do? So.
Now, do you know how, like, allergy shots work?
They give you small doses of the allergen, and over time, your eosinophils become desensitized to them. And so it's kind of like if you get mold in your allergy shots, it's like every week mold, and your eosinophils go, oh, that's that boring stuff. It's not exciting anymore to play with, and the allergy response gets less and less over time. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I used to be allergic to peanuts, and I got allergy shots for like 2 years.
And that worked for you?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Yeah, I take them too for like mold and, you know, hay fever, but it does seem to reduce your sensitivity to that antigen. All right, let's see. Our next one is a basophil. And what color are the granules here?
Purple.
Good. Kind of a purplish blue color. And they are so strongly colored that you really can't see that nucleus in the background. And if you were to be able to see the nucleus, it would be a 2 or 3-lobed nucleus. And that's confusing, right? Because we've already got a 2 and a 3-lobed white blood cell. So probably the best telltale sign for a basophil is look for the blue to purple colored granules. So these are our least common white blood cells, and those granules in there contain histamine. What does histamine do? Vasodilate, good. What happens to your vessels when they vasodilate? They get larger, they widen up, right. And I know this is taking a leap forward to blood pressure, but do you know what happens to your blood pressure when your vessels relax? It drops, right. So histamine can make your vessels leaky, it can make them widen and dilate, and if all your basophils dump their histamine granules at once, you can have a major drop in your blood pressure, and that's known as shock. Yeah. And it's called anaphylactic shock if these basophils go nuts and drop their granules. Yeah. So that's why, you know, antihistamines work against your basophils. They prevent them from dropping and losing their granules out into the cell or in the interstitial fluids. The epinephrine shots that we get for severe allergies also can constrict vessels and work against the effects of histamine. So kind of now we're starting to piece together what we understand about histamine and epinephrine working as antagonists. Interesting side note about histamine, it's also a brain neurotransmitter. That's why if you take Benadryl, you can practically go to sleep standing up. You know, so Benadryl and any other antihistamine shuts off the histamine in your brain, and therefore the sleepiness, the drowsiness kicks in. Yep. All right. Let's talk about the agranulocytes. We've got two here. We've got lymphocytes, and we've got monocytes. Looking at their pictures, how would you tell the difference? Large nucleus, no granules for the lymphocyte, good. And that monocyte has a nucleus, how would you describe it?
Kidney-shaped,
good. No granules here either. Just for the lymphocytes, they help to make antibodies. Here we are back full circle. These are the same antibodies that help attack and bind foreign antigens. These antibodies are formed especially during your childhood years, and they're matured in two main locations, your bone marrow and in your thymus gland. Okay? And so we call cells matured in your bone marrow B lymphocytes, and we call lymphocytes matured in your thymus gland T lymphocytes. Yeah. So interesting little backstory there about those lymphocytes and their antibody production. What do monocytes do for us?
Start the immune response.
They start the immune response, good. And so when they travel to a site of infection or inflammation, they transform into a really big eating cell called phagocyte, right. So macrophage, phagocyte, they're there to eat. Okay, so they eat the enemy, they clean up the place. So they're kind of like neutrophils in their role of helping to clean up. All right, so I know that half of you have had this stuff. You've been there, done that on lab tests. For the rest of you, I hope this helps you for your lab exam. Do you have any questions so far on these 5 types of white blood cells? You probably have seen this before. Never let monkeys eat bananas. That is the order of white blood cells from most common to least common. Neutrophils, of course, most common, and basophils are the very least common of any cell in our body in terms of blood cells. All right, so how about questions so far on anything we've covered today? Last on that page is thrombocytes or platelets. These little things are cell fragments. They help us clot blood. And they form from a really big multinucleated cell called a megakaryocyte. If you break that word down, what is mega?
Large.
Good. And how about kary?
Cell.
Nucleus. Yep. And of course, cyte is cell. You'll want to know the lifespan here is around 10 days. And the normal cell count, you'll want to highlight that one too, about 150,000 to 350,000 in a cubic millimeter of blood. The reason these cells, well, they're not really cells, they're cell fragments, they don't live very long, is again, they don't have a true setup with the nucleus and organelles. And since they're fragments, they get removed rather quickly from the bloodstream, again by the spleen. Anybody still need this screen? Y'all good? Okay. This big, huge cell is a megakaryocyte. It's found in the bone marrow, and it leaks off little platelets. If you've ever blown a balloon up beyond its capacity and it's exploded on you, you notice what's left behind all over the floor are these little tiny fragments of balloon pieces. That's exactly what happens with the megakaryocyte, except it doesn't exactly explode. It's just leaching off these fragments all the time, and those fragments are the platelets. The platelets then enter the blood flow, and we are able to then constantly provide new platelets for the bloodstream. You know, we need new ones, you know, every 10 days since we're pulling blood out of circulation. In this picture, you see mostly red blood cells. They have no nucleus. You can see a few white blood cells scattered through here. And then what looks to be just trash in the background are those platelets. So they are tiny, they're cell fragments. And then here you can see a platelet right here in comparison to a red blood cell on the left and a white blood cell on the right. So since platelets are involved in blood clotting, I'd like to take you there next. And I'm going to have to flip you over a page or so. You have to come with me to page 28. We'll come back to those disorders in just a moment. Okay, so we're on the top of page 28. I know you've heard of homeostasis. Here's a really similar sounding word called hemostasis. What is hemo?
Blood.
Good. And stasis? Yes, yeah, standing still, stop, stable. Okay. So basically what we want to happen here is the blood to stop moving. We want to prevent further blood loss. There are three steps here. These three steps can be completed in about 3 to 5 minutes' time. As long as the blood loss is not great, we don't have a huge cut to the vessel, usually 3 to 5 minutes will help us seal up that vessel. That does not mean that the vessel is permanently healed. You know, of course, we'll have days afterwards that the vessel will re-knit and grow back together, but simply stopping the blood loss we can accomplish in about 3 to 5 minutes. So what cells are really important that we don't want to lose? Which ones transport oxygen? Yeah, red blood cells. So we're trying to stem the loss of those red blood cells with this blood clotting process. All right, so the first step to happen when a vessel is damaged is called vascular spasms. Now, let me mention that this could be an external cut where you actually see yourself bleeding. This could also be an internal bruise or cut where you don't actually see the bleed. So we call the blood loss a hemorrhage, and it could be an internal hemorrhage. It could also be an external hemorrhage. So either way, if you damage the vessel, there is a chemical called serotonin released by platelets. That serotonin does a couple of things. It promotes these vascular spasms. How does that help us prevent blood loss?
Constricts the vessel.
Constricts the vessel, right. So all of a sudden, your nice wide open vessel has shrunk and there's less room for that blood to travel through and escape. So it's kind of like taking a hose and putting a squeeze on it. This is one step in helping us to prevent blood loss. You may notice in this picture that these collagen fibers forming the wall of our vessel are kind of hanging into the vessel. Normally, when vessels are intact, you don't see these stringy collagen fibers poking into the vessel. So that's what the platelets are going to attach to in our second step. Our second step is a platelet plug formation. And so platelets normally have no business sticking to the inside of a vessel, but once you damage the vessel and those collagen fibers are now exposed, those platelets are going to stick to those exposed collagen fibers. So if you have platelets sticking and there's no damage to the vessel, what potential problem could you have?
Clots.
Yeah. So we don't want platelets sticking unless there's a real purpose. And the purpose here is to prevent what from happening? More blood loss, right. So these platelets that are sticking to those collagen fibers, you know, they're releasing serotonin. And serotonin is kind of like a warning message that says, help me. What is one platelet saying to the other platelets floating past?
Come join me.
Yeah. It's like, I'm hanging on by a thread. I need your help, right? So they call for more platelets and more platelets to come. And the more platelets come, the more likely you are to form a platelet plug. And this sounds like what kind of feedback?
Positive.
Good. This is positive feedback. And the goal here is to form a plug, and that plug helps prevent what?
Blood loss,
right. So the goal here of a platelet plug is for more and more platelets to come, preventing that blood loss. So if you happen to have a fairly sizable cut, we usually do two things at home. What is one thing someone will recommend to you if you have a fairly sizable cut? Apply pressure, and then something else they may say to you? Could raise it, yeah. And maybe put some gauze or something on it, maybe a bandage. Okay, so if you're applying pressure, what step are you doing? Vasoconstricting through vascular spasms, good. And then secondly, if you're putting something on there like a gauze, platelet plug, yeah. Now here's the catch. If you use paper towel, toilet paper, Kleenex, even towels or even clothing, then what are those platelets sticking to? All of that, right. And so if you 10, 15 minutes later say, oh yeah, I'm gonna, you take it off, what are you pulling with it? The plug. And then what happens? Start bleeding again, right. So you got back to the beginning with this process. Bandages and gauze are treated with a chemical that inhibits platelets from sticking to them. Most of the time, right? You've probably experienced pulling off a Band-Aid or something that pulls your plug with it, and then you, ouch, you pull the scab off and you re-bleed. But most of the time, those particular chemical treatments inhibit the platelet plug from sticking to it. So, you know, you've probably heard stories of somebody being in a car accident, maybe having cut a major artery, the platelet plug adhered to the jeans the person was wearing. They don't cut the jeans off if they realize that, right? Because there you go, you've got a platelet plug that's going to have to reform and more blood loss can ensue. So, yeah, this is very quick. This can happen within minutes. And then the final step is this thing called coagulation. And coagulation is clot formation. This is why I cautioned you to not call agglutination clotting, because coagulation is truly blood clotting. Okay? So it's the third and final step of blood clot formation. And this takes our liquid blood and turns it into what?
Gel.
Good. Are you likely to leak a lot of gel? Probably not. And so here's what we're going to do. You might recall fibrinogen. What is fibrinogen? fibers. Yeah, it's a fiber-forming protein. It's in your blood. And the only time fibrinogen should actively form this mesh network called fibrin is when there's a rupture. Yeah. So when you're intact, you don't need fibrinogen to actively form fibrin. But if you damage your vessel and you go through this clotting cascade, this is what happens. There are various blood clotting factors that interact. They are numbered Roman numeral 1 through Roman numeral 10. If you read your textbook on this or read anything anywhere about it, let me caution you. They did not number them in order of their occurrence. They numbered them in order of their discovery. So that's crazy out of order numbering. So like number 6 activates number 4, and that activates number 3, and that activates number 5, and eventually you get the whole clotting cascade to occur. That clotting cascade is also going to help us turn prothrombin into thrombin. And that thrombin, that word there, tells us something. What does thromb as a prefix mean? Clot, yeah. That prothrombin to thrombin conversion helps us activate this conversion here from fibrinogen to fibrin. That is your goal. Your goal is to make fibrin. And when you make fibrin, you transform the blood from a liquid state to a gel state. Let me take you back to this picture. This thing that looks like a fishing net, that's fibrin. Okay? And in this picture, this net stuff, that's fibrin. And you can see trapped in there, it's like a spider's web, right? You've got blood cells trapped in this web. And the goal is to prevent them from being lost or any further red blood cells from being lost. That's why scabs, when they are initially forming, are jelly-like, and over time, as they dry out, they're just a dry red scab. You've got trapped red blood cells in this web or mesh network, and they're dead, of course, and eventually when the wound heals, that scab falls off. But initially, that scab starts out as a fibrin mesh network, trapping those red, and there's even a white blood cell up there at the top. And this is an actual picture of fibrin. So it takes factors 1 through 10, it takes prothrombin and thrombin, turning fibrinogen into fibrin. So like I said, your goal here is to make this mesh network, this web, called fibrin. Okay, and all of this, from cutting yourself to having a fibrin formation, 3 to 5 minutes. That's pretty darn fast. Okay, there's a video. I'm not sure we have time to watch it today. Maybe we'll watch that on maybe Thursday, we'll do that. Let me take you to the bottom of the page there, about halfway down. Items you need to clot blood effectively are vitamin K, and you also need calcium. Calcium you get from your bones if you don't have enough of it, and which hormone helps you to raise blood calcium levels? Parathyroid. Yeah. Parathyroid, PTH raises blood calcium, so if you need more for blood clotting, PTH can help do it. Down here at the bottom of your page, just a couple of things. I do want to mention to you that blood serum is something that we may store for a couple of weeks, and we may take out that fibrinogen, because if left in blood that's just sitting still, what happens to that blood? It clots, yeah. So if you leave blood just sitting in a bag, 3 to 5 minutes, it's clumped up and clotted. Yep. So over time, you know, if we're talking about making a clot in your vessel, we want to heal the vessel, grow it back together, and then we want to perform something called fibrinolysis. What does the lysis suffix tell you? Rupture, split, right? So we're going to rupture or split that fibrin web. And if you've healed your blood vessel, why do you want to destroy that fibrin web? Yeah, let the blood flow through, right? If you don't remove the fibrin web, you are left with a clot hanging on inside your vessel. And what do we call that stationary clot?
A thrombus.
Good. Okay, so a thrombus is a stationary clot. That can be dangerous. That can block blood flow to a vital area. Also dangerous is an embolus or an embolism. That's a clot on the move. A lot of clots on the move hit vital organs like the lungs, and we call that a pulmonary embolism. If it hits your heart, we can have a heart attack. If it hits your brain, it can cause a stroke. Okay? So an embolism is a moving clot. And the question next says, how are thrombus and embolisms related to fibrinolysis? That's great. Incomplete, right. So fibrinolysis failed to complete, or you could say it's incomplete fibrinolysis. Good. Okay, and as some people age, they may experience more problems with fibrinolysis, and they may throw blood clots more frequently, and that's why we have a huge host of blood thinners. You know, we call them warfarin, Coumadin, Xarelto, Pradaxa. There's a bunch of them out there now. So those will help prevent this fibrin formation. Incomplete fibrinolysis. So incomplete clot breakdown. Just want to mention at the very bottom of your page, the term anticoagulant is oftentimes called a blood thinner. And we know that blood thinness is related to the viscosity, or how many blood cells and how much fluid you're transporting. So blood thinner really kind of gives us the wrong idea. What anticoagulants actually do is what?
Stop clotting.
Stop clotting, right. And which step do they interfere with? The first, vascular spasms, the second, platelet plug formation, or the third step?
Third step,
good. So the third step is called coagulation, and it results in the formation of a web called
fibrin,
right. So people who take anticoagulants interfere with some part of the formation of fibrin. And so, yeah, here's a huge list of them. These drugs work on different parts of that clotting cascade. Some will interfere with the factors. Some will interfere with, you know, vitamin K and the conversion there into clotting factors. So each one of these drugs has a different mechanism that they work by. But nonetheless, they interfere with that coagulation, formation of fibrin. Why don't we say blood disorders? If you'll read over those, we'll kind of hit those quickly on Thursday. We'll do a little bit of heart, and then Thursday, bring your questions for test number 1.